that it's at this period that there's one of the strains of Irish nationalism that emerges, agrarian radicalism, that became known as ribbonism. It's basically peasants rising up against their landlords, taking up reprisals against their landlords, attacking their property, destroying their livestock, and the form of secret societies, as the agrarian societies like the White Boys, the Oak Boys, Children of Queen Maeve, and so forth, disguise themselves most often in women's clothing when they raid the landlord. Obviously, for a very poor population, the easiest way to disguise yourself is to put on women's clothing. What else do they have? Then you get the next stage in the 1790s, because there's this radicalization of the Protestant population, and two strains within the Protestant population, a sort of Republican radicalism, and then Orangeism, you know, reaction, Ku Klux Klan type anti-Catholic reaction. But what emerges in the 1790s is a current among the Protestant middle class that is radical and Republican and identifies with the French and American Revolution. And it reflects the social structure of the Protestant community and not the Catholic community. Since at this point the Catholic community has no rights whatsoever, it's completely depressed, despoiled, can't hold any property, has no rights, doesn't have the right to vote, you know, doesn't have the right to have the whole laws. Under the worst of the penal laws, a Catholic wasn't allowed to own anything that was worth more than £5. If a Protestant family with a horse worth more than £5, you could just give them £5 and demand that you give them the horse. It's one of the reasons. Like Protestants, the rich Protestants in Ireland are known as horse Protestants, identified with that. But the Protestant community, on the other hand, is like an extension of England and Scotland into Ireland. The same processes are happening in it as they're happening in Scotland. You know, there's the rise of the bourgeoisie, the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, you know, new industries, the growth of science, you know, challenge to the old religious ideas, to the old political ideas. And that takes the form of republicanism in Ireland, which is essentially, you know, a movement of the Protestant middle class and upper middle class. But the Protestant, this rising bourgeoisie, or this layer in Ireland that aspires to become a revolutionary bourgeoisie, you know, like the class that made the revolution in the United States or in France, it aspires to, or in order to create a national economy, it has to find some way to unite Ireland economically as a basis for its economic power. And to unite Ireland economically, to make it one market, it has to bridge the gap between the Protestants and the Catholics. And so the leaders of this Protestant republicanism look for bridges to the Catholics. There's a committee for the emancipation of the Catholics, Wolfe Tone, who's the leader of the United Irishmen, the Revolution of 1798, is one of the major figures in this Catholic emancipation committee. And they also argue that you're going to have to be able, you're going to have to learn Irish in order to deal with the Irish-speaking peasants, because everybody's in the countryside at this point, everybody still speaks Irish, or most people speak Irish. So if you're going to trade with the Irish population, you have to speak Irish. And there's an attempt by the United Irishmen to interest people in the older Irish culture. This is the point where the older Irish music is recovered. Bunting, who was one of the United Irishmen, holds a concert for the surviving harpers, and they recover the old harp tunes, and they also issue a textbook for learning Irish and a periodical publication in Irish, you know, to put together the old lore. But it's designed as a bridge between the Catholic and Protestant populations. Now, the problem is, though, that what the United Irishmen, you know, they initially pressed for some kind of democratic reform in Ireland. And the British wouldn't accept that. They were pushed to rebellion. And when they rose up, the Catholic peasantry, the majority of the country, rose up with them. But it went beyond them. I mean, for the Catholic peasantry, this republicanism didn't mean very much. What they were interested in was driving the settlers out. The renewal of the ancient rebellion, drive the settlers out, Irish Ireland. And that scared the Northern Irish Protestants definitively. So that the Northern Irish bourgeoisie gives up the idea of uniting Ireland, and they opt instead for a form of industrialization that's like a triangular trade, where you have Belfast that develops as an industrial center, and it imports its raw materials from Great Britain and exports its products to Great Britain. Between, basically, there's a triangle between Belfast, Glasgow, and Liverpool. And it becomes, separated from the rest of Ireland. And then, the Irish nationalist movement again becomes a predominantly Catholic movement. It's a movement of the Catholic population. But the Catholic population that has adopted the ideology of the United Irishmen as their ideology. I mean, that's the radical current within the Catholic population. What arises after the defeat of the Revolution of 1798 is a movement for Catholic emancipation within the British state, led by O'Connell. It's interesting, it's probably the first mass movement in the Western world. A movement where the mass of the peasantry was organized. They paid a thing called the Catholic rent that supported a movement. And they organized mass demonstrations, the biggest one being on the Hill of Tara in 1848 that was supposedly 1.25 million people. Now, this is a time when Ireland had a population of 9 million. But it's a similar thing happens. These are the first stage of modern mass movements, like the Chartists in England, where there would be the first modern workers' movement. It was also a movement of protest and mass demonstrations. It wasn't organized to take power, and it wasn't prepared for a confrontation with the state. So when the state in England declared the mass demonstrations illegal and arrested the leaders, the movement collapsed. The same thing happened in Ireland. When they declared the mass demonstrations illegal, the movement collapsed. What made it worse in Ireland was that when the movement collapsed at the same time that Ireland was hit by the Great Famine, it's the greatest disaster in Irish history. Within a few years, the population of Ireland was reduced almost by half. There were a couple of million people who died of starvation. There were others who fled to the United States and other places. And the old civilization died. People stopped. That's the point where people stopped speaking Irish. Is the idea is if you're going to survive, you're probably going to have to go to the United States or England. You're going to have to deal with the English administration. Irish is just a burden. Everybody has to learn English. Now, that was also, O'Connell had that idea also. He was a lawyer, and, the Irish people had to be able, he had the idea that Irish people should defend their rights in court. Therefore, they had to know English. They had to be able to defend themselves in English. Now, the older civilization, the older culture was just a burden that had to be cast off. So that's one of the dividing lines. But what emerges in 1848 is like a second edition of the Republican movement. That is, there was a wing of the O'Connell movement that moved to the left of O'Connell, and in it, in particular, Protestant intellectuals played a big role, like people like Thomas Davis. Thomas Davis would be the most important figure in this movement. He became known as the Young Irish, the Young Irishman. He would have been the most important figure. They had a magazine called The Nation that had the idea that you had to build up an Irish culture that would be in English. The Nation was in English. It published ballads, poetry. The slogan was that the poets were more important as builders of nationhood than the legislators were. And although they had the idea of just pursuing reforms also, they were pushed into rebellion by the famine. There was an abortive rebellion in 1848 that was crushed. But out of the rebellion of 1848, there's a new revolutionary movement that comes out, the Fenians. Now, the Fenians, it's a transitional stage in a way, because it's an English-speaking movement. It's not identified with the old Gaelic culture. you know, it's the movement of an English-speaking people for independence of Ireland as an English-speaking state. You know, it would be something like the United States. But the name Fenian is from Old Irish lore. Fenians were an elite military order that was supposed to have existed in early Christian Ireland to defend Ireland from the Vikings and so on. So that the name represents a certain identification with the older Gaelic civilization. And there were people within the Fenian movement who favored the use of Irish and the revival of Irish, O'Donovan Rossa being the most prominent of them. The Fenian movement, it becomes a military conspiratorial movement, like most of the revolutionary movements after the defeat of the French Revolution in Europe. You know, there's the idea that, the bourgeois revolutions didn't solve things. You needed something more radical, but there wasn't any idea of a complete social program for organizing the people or for making a revolution. The idea was that the most dedicated people should take power through the means of a military conspiracy. Now, the problem with military conspiracy, it failed everywhere. It fails because if you keep the activity and the goals of the movement secret from the state, they're also secret from the population. And so you're cutting yourself off from your support. The other thing is that a conspiracy is always infiltratable. And typically in Ireland, these conspiratorial movements were always infiltrated. It explains the Irish obsession with informers, because the movement was always betrayed by informers. But there's the division between, like at this point, between the Fenians and the Church. The Church, the Fenians, this is the point where the Church, the Catholic Church, has made its peace with England. Like after Catholic emancipation in the 1830s, then even earlier than that, the English state endowed the Catholic seminary in Ireland, Maynooth. So that there's English state support for the Catholic Church in Ireland. And the papacy itself is interested in Irish Catholics basically as a bridgehead within the United Kingdom. You know? They're not interested in Irish separation. They're interested in using the Irish as a bridgehead to regain some power for England or some power for the Church within England. England is the big prize. It's the major power of the period, after all. You know? The papacy aspires to influence England. And the Catholic Church becomes a collaborator of English power in Ireland. In the 1850s, you get the emergence of an Irish parliamentary party as a parliamentary party that favors Irish autonomy or home rule. But the Catholic Church is opposed to the Irish party. They favor voting for the British Liberals instead, for the English Liberals instead. You know, so the parliamentary party has to be built against the Church. And the Fenians also, they favor organizing the population for a violent uprising, and so they're also against the Church. The Church condemns them. If you were known to have taken the Fenian oath, you couldn't get communion in the Church. The next big stage is the development of the land movement in Ireland, the Land League. 1870s. It's powerful precisely because it bridges this gap. You see, the parish priests are interested in defending the rights of the tenants, and the tenants force the priests to defend their rights. They can't defend the landlord against them, not completely anyway. But then the only movement in Ireland that has organizers that can organize the peasants to fight the landlords is the Fenians. So that you get a fusion between the local parish priests, the Fenian movement, and the Irish Parliamentary Party led by Parnell at this point, the Land League agitation. It breaks the old feudal system in Ireland, the system of landlordism where the peasants have no rights. They were so-called tenants at will, which meant they could be expelled by the landlords at any time. And there's a struggle that takes place in the 1870s. It ends with the so-called Treaty of Kilmainham Jail in 1881, where, Parnell was arrested and Michael Davitt, who was a more radical leader, was arrested. and the British government agreed to let them out if they would call off the land agitation. And then the British government agreed to carry out a series of land reforms, which it did. You know, there's a series of land reforms in the end of the 19th century. It became known as killing home rule by kindness. You know, supposedly they were giving the peasants what they wanted so they didn't need to rebel against the English crown. But since the land agitation is called off, it left Parnell isolated. That is, the mass movement was demobilized. It left him isolated, and the Catholic Church moved against him. They used this fact that he was living with a woman married to someone else as to start this campaign to break him. Now, it was a complete pretext because, you know, she hadn't been living with her husband for years. The husband knew it. Everybody knew it, you know. But it's, you know, it was formally against the morality of the Catholic Church and the dissenting sects that were the basis of British liberalism. You know, the British liberals who were supposed to offer all these reforms. So the Catholics had two arguments. One, it's immoral. We can't stand it. We can't leave the virtuous Catholic peasantry. The other thing is, if he does, it's going to alienate the virtuous English liberals who are our allies. So it becomes a watershed. Parnell, the movement is split, and Parnell is basically driven into his grave. Now, you find a lot of reflections of this in modern Irish literature. You know, in Joyce, for example, is the great tragedy of the crucifixion of Parnell. It's seen in those light, in that light, the crucifixion of Parnell. And there's demoralization. And then in the 1890s, a new movement arises. You know, it's a cultural movement that develops and takes the center stage because on the political level, there's demoralization. The Irish Party is discredited. And the idealists and the radicals move into the cultural movement. The cultural movement is the Gaelic League, founded in 1892. And the Gaelic League, for the first time, is a nationalist organization in Ireland that's based on the idea of restoring Irish as the language of the country. And that the restoration of Irish as the language of the country would not just mean a linguistic change, but a cultural change. That is, that it couldn't restore Ireland of the 12th century, but the idea is that it would create a society that would be rooted in the values of the Gaelic resistance and would be something like, you know, their idea of what that society would have developed in the And within the Gaelic League, you get the emergence of the Irish-Ireland School. The Irish-Ireland School is the most radical school that's appeared in Irish nationalism so far. It calls for, its slogan was, we don't need to repeal the Act of Union. The Act of Union was what abolished the Dublin Parliament, you know, and made Ireland, you know, directly dependent on England. That is, the Irish representatives were elected to the British Parliament. We don't need to repeal just the Act of Union, we have to repeal the conquest and everything that the conquest represented. Well, what the conquest represented was capitalism. You know, you have this contradiction that I talked about, one of the basic contradictions in Irish history being the peripheralness of Ireland to Europe. So that Ireland was affected by all of the social changes that took place in Europe, but never completely transformed by them. You have the pattern of the conquest also, where Ireland is overwhelmed by the rising English state, but the class transformations of England were never completed in Ireland. The feudal system couldn't be completed because the English king was afraid of feudal lords developing in Ireland that could challenge his authority. So that the development of the feudal system in Ireland was curtailed by the British crown. Also, the British bourgeoisie didn't want the development of Irish industry in an Irish bourgeoisie because that would be competition. So they prevented the development of any kind of normal capitalism in Ireland. The class nature of the country was always distorted by the English overlordship, but never transformed by it. So, you know, the Irish-Ireland Party calls for destroying the conquest and values of English civilization. It would mean rebelling against capitalism and the values and the law of the English state. And it's basically this generation that went through the Gaelic League who became the leaders of the Dublin Uprising of 1916 that ushers in the War of Independence in Ireland. Now, also, since they're radicals, you see, they become a lot, they find other allies in Ireland. They're not just on the cultural front or the radical Republican front, but it's in the beginning of the 20th century where a labor movement arises in Ireland. And it's a labor movement that arises in very different conditions than in England. That is, in England, there's a certain order and habit of obedience and respect for the established institutions. In Ireland, in this situation of constant conflict, the trade union movement arises as an insurrectionary movement. Strikes tend to take on an insurrectionary character. The leaders of the Irish labor movement are socialist revolutionaries, James Connolly and James Larkin. And as revolutionists, they are attracted to the Irish-Ireland wing. Both of them sent their children to the school that was run by Patrick Pearse, that was run entirely in Irish, and based on his concept of the values of ancient Irish society. And Connolly argued for support for the Irish language movement on the basis that it was a movement that represented the dispossessed against the establishment. And the alliance is solidified in the Dublin General Strike of 1913. That's the biggest trade union battle of the beginning of the, beginning of the 20th century. And it also represents a class divide in the sense that the Dublin strike, it's a strike of transport workers in Dublin. It's a strike against a Catholic capitalist, William Martin Murphy, you know, who was a Catholic capitalist. He controlled the Irish Independent, you know, he was the major Catholic newspaper at the time. So that, you know, the question is then, you know, you claim to be an Irish nationalist. What does that mean socially? Does it mean supporting the likes of William Martin Murphy, who used the British state to try and crush the transport worker strike? Or does it mean supporting Connolly and the revolutionary movement? Connolly formed a kind of a nucleus of a workers' army in the general strike, the Irish Citizens' Army. It's one of the components of the Dublin Uprising. And, you know, when as you get moved toward 1916, this alliance between Connolly, who represents the revolutionary socialist movement, and Pearse, who would represent the radical cultural movement, the radical Republican movement, the Gaelic movement, is more and more solidified. Except the difference is that remains that Connolly is much clearer about what he wants than Pearse is. Pearse is an idealist, a romantic. You know, Connolly is a materialist. And it appears, if you look into the the background of the Dublin Uprising, that it was basically Connolly who forced the Dublin Uprising. That is, he overcame the hesitations of Pearse and forced the movement into an uprising. Because 1916 was the worst year of the war, they were afraid that the British would be able to enforce conscription in Ireland. You know. And there's also the effect of the history of failures in the 19th century, where there were always these preparations for rebellions, and then none ever took place. So they needed to actually carry out an armed uprising to prove that they were serious. Connolly was clearer about the need for an armed uprising and about the way to organize it than Pearse was, but they both shared the same idea. But then, see, this also brings to the point, what is Irish nationalism? You know, is it a continuation of the resistance of the British conquest to the conquest of Ireland by the Anglo-Norman monarchy in 1167 through to the present, or is it something new, something that dates from 1798, or something that dates from the peasant movement of the 1870s? I mean, the answer to that question determines a lot what your strategy and your orientation is. Connolly, I think, was clearest on this. He also explained what the English conquest represented. That is, basically it was a struggle between a class society. As feudalism is a class society, and as a class society, it maintains a state, a professional army. The basis of a state, as Marxist explains, is that you need a repressive apparatus to defend the rich few against the poor many. And although the state is rudimentary under feudalism, there's a definite state, you know, prison, gallows. That was another thing the English demanded that the Earl of Tyrone do, was set up a gallows as well as a prison, employ a sheriff, a police force, you know. So there was a conflict between ancient Irish society, which in principle was collective and democratic, and this rising and not a state, and then the various stages in the development of the modern state that were imposed by the English monarchy in the different forms that it took. So in that sense, there's a unity of the movement against the English conquest that goes all the way back. You know, it links the resistance to the establishment of feudalism in Ireland, the resistance to the establishment of the modern British state in Ireland, to the rise of the revolutionary socialist movement and the revolutionary peasant movement. There's that social continuity. Now, what Irish nationalism represents historically is the resistance to the conquest and specifically the imposition of the different stages of class society that the conquest represented. And so in that sense, the question of the Irish language becomes a central question in Irish nationalism. It's not just a romantic idea that one generation had. This is, I say, you know, before 1916, there was no, from 1798 to the 1890s, there was no identification between the Irish language and Irish nationalism. The idea was that you make a revolution in Ireland that would produce a state that would be like the United States. You know, be independent, but it wouldn't be culturally or socially fundamentally different from any modern state. But in this sense, the Irish language representing the values of the old Irish society and the continuation of that resistance and the rejection of the conquest becomes central to modern Irish nationalism. It explains why, you know, the literature that was created by the Gaelic League, modern Irish literature in Irish, is dominated by socialists. That is, that the two major prose writers in modern Irish literature in Irish, Máirtín Ócáin and Padraig O'Connor, are both revolutionary socialists. You know, whereas if you look at the people who wrote in English in Ireland, some of them, I mean, like, they generally have no clear political point of view, or if they do, it's a reformist, neo-colonialist point of view, and not revolutionists. Even though some, you know, like people like Frank O'Connor and Sean O'Fallon were Republicans, they fought on the Republican side in the Civil War, you know, but they are, you know, they rejected Republicanism later and became Free Staters. Whereas, you know, O'Kain remained a Republican. He was interned during the war when all the IRA people were interned, and he, in the 1960s, he became a very clear revolutionary socialist. He identified with revolutionary socialist struggles, anti-imperialist struggles around the world. The same way was true of O'Connor, who's an early writer, that is someone who flourished, say, from about between 1910 and 1930, who was the first important prose writer in modern Irish. The most radical writer in modern Irish literature in English is Liam O'Flaherty, but O'Flaherty was a native Gaelic speaker and from the Aran Islands. And his brother, Tom O'Flaherty, was one of the founders of the American Communist Party. I think he may have been imprisoned for a time in the United States, as James Larkin was imprisoned for a time in the United States. Both Larkin and Connolly emigrated to the United States for a period. They were, Connolly went back to Ireland in 1910. Larkin stayed here until the 20s, and he was imprisoned in the anti-communist Palmer raids in the 20s. And not released until Al Smith became governor of New York. Al Smith being Irish Catholic, he let Larkin out of jail. Larkin went back to Ireland, you know. But when Tom O'Flaherty went back to Ireland, he was one of the central people in the first regular all-Irish publication called An Pearnach, The Irishman, which is the most radical publication in Ireland in the 30s. You know, the only one that wasn't dominated by Catholic anti-communism. So forth, the deposed Franco. So that's the basic outline of the thing. Now, I just would mention in conclusion, this is getting very long, anything that has to do with Irish history tends to get very long. But, you know, in the 1970s, when the movement, the nationalist movement, reemerged in Northern Ireland, there was a question of what attitude to take toward the Protestants. You know, were they misunderstood Irishmen, or misunderstood Irish nationalists? See, the traditional Republican idea is that they're misunderstood Irish nationalists, not that they're a settler population. So you had some of the Republican theoreticians saying that when the British troops attacked the Protestants, the IRA should attack the British Army other places in Belfast to draw them off. Well, the British troops only attacked the Protestants because there was public pressure on them to try and prevent the Protestant gangs from attacking Catholic housing projects. So, you know, if you would attack the British Army to prevent them from stopping the Protestants from massacring Catholics, it wouldn't make you very popular with the Catholics. And you had this division between the official IRA and the provisional IRA, where the